Hi friends, you're listening to Convos with me, Kathy Clark. Gary and I are the lead pastors at Hillsong Church in the UK. I'm so happy to have you join us in the conversation today. This program is for you, and really all we're doing is having a good, honest talk about real life stories. So whether you're on your daily commute, you're in the car, or you're at home with a coffee, sit back and I hope you enjoy today's chat. And by the way, don't forget to join the conversation on Instagram using the hashtag Convos with Kathy. You right to go?
Yep.
Anytime? All going? All good? Okay, so well today it's a massive welcome because we've got Erwin McManus here with us, and I'm really excited, Erwin, to be able to be chatting with you and having a conversation with you today.
I'm so honored to be here with you. And it's kind of beautiful. We have the music in the background. We are in the middle of color and just experiencing how God is moving in people's lives.
So
it's kind of a great background.
Yep. So if anyone can hear the noise in the background.
It's not noise. It's worship.
Yeah, we haven't forgotten to turn off something in this little room. We are actually just sitting in a dressing room, backstage of color, and the session is just finishing in there, but you're a fabulous friend to Hillsong, the whole global family for Hillsong.
Well, really. I love all of you guys so much.
And we've sort of certainly embraced you and adopted you into the color sisterhood as well now. You've spoken in Sydney
Color. Yes.
And we're really, really privileged to have been able to have you now join us in London for color as well.
Well, I'm honored, but I want to know, why did I get a text from Gary inviting me, not from you?
Oh.
Because I just can't believe for a minute that Gary's in charge of this. I think it has to be you.
Okay. Well, you know what? If you're looking, it does say girl boss, but I'm not sure whether it's so much girl boss in this house.
Yeah, all right.
Maybe it's just boy boss in this house.
No, it's beautiful. It's all right. Brian texts me first from Sydney,
too. You got a text from Brian?
Yeah.
And you got a text from Gary? And Bobby and I are right in there. We were very excited when we heard that you were able to be able to join.
I was shocked and honored.
Why were you shocked?
I just wasn't expecting to be invited to speak at color. And
have you spoken at many women's conferences before?
I think this is my first one. I think that I've just opened up a new new career choice and a career path. I spoke at the Color in Sydney, and I think that was the first women's conference I ever spoke at. Then last week I was in Mexico, and I spoke at a business summit of all businesswomen.
Okay.
And then I flew from Mexico to here, to London, to speak here at Color. So I've never done any in my life, and then this summer now I'm doing three, which is crazy.
Clocking them up. And, you know, there are a lot of women's conferences around the world, so you just could have opened up a whole new door.
Well,
can
I'll tell
of worms,
you what.
Door, however you want to look at
it. It is exciting to speak to a group of people who are actually readers. And I think for a long time I'd see that 85% of books that were purchased are by women.
Right.
And, you know, I'm a writer, so I love people who love the art of literature, of writing. And, and so that actually excites me to open up a whole new audience and to have people enter into a conversation that I feel really connected to.
Oh, that's interesting. So you would find that by far the majority of people who would, say, purchase your books would be women?
No.
No.
That's why I'm so glad to be speaking.
Oh, I see. I get you.
Because I really haven't been introduced into that particular tribe. And most of my books are read by men.
Right. Gotcha.
And because my titles are very intense and masculine, but they're really not masculine. They're heroic. And I think that's the mistake people make.
Yeah.
The Way of the Warrior is not a masculine title. It's a heroic title.
Yeah.
And The Last Arrow is not masculine. It's heroic. And I find that, especially now you see this in like Marvel, all the movies, and there really is an emerging awareness that women are heroic, and that not only are they heroic, but we need them to lead. We need them to rise up and become everything that God created them to be.
Yeah, sure. So the last book that you've produced, you're quite a prolific writer, aren't you?
I've written 10 books.
10. So that's a lot of material.
It is. Yeah.
To be producing and to be putting into print. Your most recent one is The Way of the Warrior.
That's right.
And the theme of that is, because I actually like the rest of the tagline there.
The subtitle is An Ancient Path to Inner Peace.
Yes.
Right.
I really love that. I love that ancient path to inner peace.
Yeah. The publishers, it's interesting, when they got the book, they told me, we're surprised you talk about Jesus so much. And because I don't really begin my books in that sense with an agenda. Yeah. And I'm trying to deal with real issues in life and see where it takes me.
Yeah.
And I told him, I said, I couldn't write about peace without running into Jesus every single time.
Right.
And so the book really is, I think, like beautifully interwoven with the story of Jesus. But it wasn't because I was trying to subtly use the book just to talk about Jesus. It's the other way around. I was talking about inner peace, and it always led me to conversations about Jesus.
I am curious to hear what you might have to say. Do you think it really is possible to achieve inner peace?
I do. In fact, this morning I was telling my daughter, I woke up this morning reminding myself, well, I don't know if I was reminding myself or just had this overwhelming reminder of how much I've enjoyed my life. Mm-hmm. And there are people who are depressed who have moments of happiness. Mm-hmm. And there are people who are genuinely happy who have moments of depression. I fall into that category.
Yeah.
In fact, if I've ever felt really badly at times, I've actually felt badly that I love life so much, that I enjoy life so much.
Yeah.
It feels unfair because I know so many people struggle for it and never attain it. But I've stopped feeling guilty for loving life and just decided to spread that as far as I can and help other people love it too.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so you think it is possible to have inner peace and to experience that. What about outside Jesus, do you think that it's possible?
I think that everything is on a spectrum. And inner peace is not a constant, even if you know Jesus.
Yeah.
And so there's I think there's two extreme misunderstandings. One, if you know Jesus, you always have inner peace. That's not true.
Yeah.
And the other one would be, if you don't know Jesus, you can't have inner peace. Mm. But like both of them, they're inner worlds of chaos and turmoil. Mm. And so the challenge when you try to find inner peace without Jesus is that no one can get into your soul except for you.
Yeah.
So you're fighting a battle all by yourself. And that's why people end up giving up and surrendering themselves to less. When you open your life to God and you invite Jesus into your life, now you have the Prince of Peace fighting for the peace inside of you. So you've invited the most powerful warrior that has ever existed into your inner world to fight the battle with you and for you. And I think that to me is like what's so powerful is that I don't have to fight this battle alone. So the question isn't, can you have days of peace and days of war? The question is, are you going to fight this battle every single day of your life alone?
Right.
Or are you going to allow the God who created you to fight it for you?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I was just wondering what your take is on the whole anxiety thing, because that's connected with your inner peace.
It is very much.
Do you think it's more prevalent now, or is it just something that we are talking about more that is making us more aware of social anxiety or, well, there's many levels of anxiety?
I think that's one of the prevailing questions right now is do we have more of this or do we have more awareness of this? Mm. I actually think we have more of it.
Right.
And I think there's several reasons for that is that when we lived in a more rural environment, the world moved seasonally. It moved really slow.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had less turbulence on your life.
Yeah.
We've become a cosmopolitan world. The world is moving incredibly fast. A 10-year-old has more information about global issues than a president did 100 years ago.
Yeah.
So you're trying to ask a child with an undeveloped psychological framework who doesn't have the tools to deal with terrorism and global warming and wars and societal conflicts and stability and government and economics. And that child doesn't understand all that. They understand, they just feel the pressure of it all. And I think what's happening is that we have an accelerated amount of psychological pressure on us.
Yeah.
But we do not have an accelerated amount of resilience within us.
Yeah.
So our level of resilience has actually been decreasing and our level of pressure has actually increased.
Okay.
And I think that's what's creating anxiety, stress, panic attacks, and depression.
So I don't personally see us being able to roll back the clock and go back to a rural... Like, I grew up on a farm.
Yeah.
My mum and dad still live on the farm. And I had quite a sort of carefree, I consider, quite a carefree, easy young childhood. Didn't grow up in a Christian home. But nevertheless, it was carefree and easy. Mm-hmm. We just go out and play in the paddocks and ride the horses and ride the motorbikes around.
I want your childhood.
But I don't know whether I see generally, we're becoming more and more an urbanized
right.
world, aren't we? So is it going to be able to wind it back and become more stress-free?
And that's the problem, is that most of the solutions to the issues of anxiety and depression we have are get away from the city, get out into the country, go to the ranch or the farm. And this is not realistic, because if everyone goes to the farm, it's going to become the city. And so we're not going to roll back time, as you said. We're going to have to create new strategies for higher resilience to deal with the new world in which we live. And if you look at technology and the massive amount of information we have, and everybody's always berating us all now, but we hold our phone every second, it's our adult pacifier, but the flip side of it is, when my kids were younger and there were no mobile phones, they didn't see me all day because I was in an office or I was in a building or I was in meetings in some other space. We'd have a fax machine. They would print out all my emails and I have to go through them on a stack. And once the cell phone came in, I could actually go to my son's soccer game or go to his football game and still work from there.
Yeah.
And so it looks like it's all downside when we go, look, you're working all the time. You're always connected. But on the flip side, before we were completely disconnected. You never saw your dad. I mean, I don't know about you, but I never saw my stepdad. He was always gone.
Yeah.
My mom also worked full time, and I pretty much never saw her.
Yeah.
We had a nanny in our house from El Salvador, because we're from El Salvador, and that was a part of the custom of the culture. We were with our nannies all the time, but we had very, very small access to our parents. So I think on the upside, I'm so much more available now because of the mobility of the phone.
Yeah.
But on the downside, every second of my life, I have something demanding my attention. And so it's creating an unhealthy extroversion where you're not taking time to go into your inner world to reflect, to pay attention to who you are and to deal with the health inside of you. And I think that's the downside. It's not that we have all these pressures around us, is that they're pulling us out when sometimes we need to actually pull ourselves in, deal with the health and strength of our soul, find ourselves rest. I mean, neurologically, you can find that if a person takes an hour a day and disconnects from all outside activity, their brain will actually heal faster and they will become more generative, more creative, more imaginative.
Yeah. All right. Well, we could do that. take that hour out. I love it. Right now we've got the dog chilling here under the table and she's just looking like she's got relax and stress-free life sorted out.
That's great.
we should learn something from them. But you mentioned just something just before you were preaching, and you were saying that what you believe we should do more is open up the conversation about depression because there are more, it is more prevalent that people feel like, whether it's anxiousness or depression. And I thought about that when you mentioned it, and I thought, now, it would take someone with a lot of vulnerability and a lot of courage to open up the conversation about depression, because it's almost a bit of a, do you want to admit that? Do you want to own up to that? Do people want to own up to that? Or is it a little bit of a shame thing to start going there and going, oh, I don't know if I feel depressed or what I'm going through? You suggested that it's good to open up that conversation.
I think it's important to realize that depression does not put you in a separate category. And so today, at the opening session at Color, I basically said, if you're struggling with depression or anxiety or these kinds of issues, I want you to stand.
Yeah.
And I think pretty close to every woman in the room stood. And so you're talking about, I don't know how many, 11,000 women standing up, declaring to each other, I'm struggling with this too.
Yeah.
And I think what's really important is to realize that being depressed doesn't make you different than everybody else.
Yeah.
Being depressed actually makes you just like everybody else.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
And so once you realize, oh, it's normative.
Yeah.
I'm not broken so badly I can't get healed. I am broken, but I'm broken in the same spectrum as every other human being. And sometimes, when I'm in a more jaded kind of state of mind, I talk about how depression is the luxury of the rich.
Right.
Because when you're poor and you're working in the coal mine or you're working in a farm, you just get up and go to work. And I don't think you're not depressed when you're working in that coal mine.
Yeah.
I don't think you're not depressed when you're working at slave labor on that farm. I think you just get up and you go to work and you take care of your family and your kids and you just do what you got to do. And I imagine in the States, during the immense time of slavery, the women and men who were working the cotton fields were pretty depressed.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
I mean, you're not free. You're enslaved. You lose your husband and wife at the slave owner's whim. You lose your children once they are a commodity to be sold. I think an entire culture lived with massive depression, but they didn't have the luxury of being depressed and staying home and not working that farm, not working those fields. And so there's a sense where there's a parallel between our freedom, our affluence, our opportunity, and our feeling of and our paralysis, depression, anxiety, and phobias, because we actually have the luxury of depression.
Okay, yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm digesting that. As you're saying that, I'm digesting
I know
that.
It's a very odd thing to say.
Yeah.
And also, like, I remember years ago, I went to my mom and I asked her, because, you know, as I've gotten older, I realized I had so many opportunities that I didn't even know about. Mm. I didn't know I could become this or that. And you ever notice that if you grew up and your parents are actors, you just become an actor? Or if your dad's a doctor, you become a doctor. If your dad's a president, you become a president. And because once you know it's possible, it's doable for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I remember going back to my mom and saying, "Mom, why didn't you like tell us that we could do all these different things?" And she told me, she became a follower of Christ at 40. She said, "Before I met Jesus, my world was really small." Mm. And then I became a person of faith, and it's like the whole world opened up to me.
Okay.
And I think we don't talk about that enough. And so the reason where I'm going with this is that a part of depression is that you actually know you have options for a different life.
Right.
And so if you think this is all there is, you actually don't experience that, what would psychologically be defined as depression. You're depressed, but you're not sitting there thinking to yourself, "Oh, if I just made these different choices or I'd gone a different direction, I could have done this." Mm-hmm. And so I feel like depression in some ways comes because we actually do have options.
Yeah.
And so then what we cannot reconcile is, did we lose the future we longed for? Or did someone steal it from us?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And it creates this tension of internal turmoil.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is, I think about it, that it's a day-to-day life. It's day-to-day decisions and a journey, because that's choices that we make.
That's right.
Every day.
The smallest chapter in The Way of the Warrior is, I think, Code 5. And it's about taking ownership for your life. And one of the things that I've seen is that people who displace responsibility, who displace blame, people who always blame other people or blame their parents. Maybe you had terrible parents. It has nothing to do with that.
Yeah.
And there are people who had worse parents who still don't blame their parents.
Yeah.
But when you blame the government or blame your parents or blame the church or blame the world or blame society, you actually move toward depression.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And when you take responsibility for your life and you take ownership for your choices, you actually develop resilience.
Yeah.
So I always tell people, look, it may not be your fault, but it is your responsibility.
Yeah.
And one of the most difficult things in the world is to own the fact that maybe you actually are not to blame. And it's someone else is to blame, but someone else isn't responsible to change your life.
Mm.
So you have no control over the life you lived or the life that was given to you. And you didn't control whether your parents were alcoholics. You didn't control whether your dad abandoned you. You had no control over whether you were abused. You have no control over whether you were isolated or emotionally deprived of love and affection.
Yeah.
You didn't have control over that.
Yeah.
And one of the hardest things in the world is to go, life is unfair. And so someone needs to make this up to me. Mm-hmm. No, life is unfair. And now you have to decide what you're going to do with the life you have.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think a really good question that everyone can ask themselves is, what am I in control of?
That's a great question. Talk a lot about how a part of anxiety is trying to control things that are out of your control and refusing to take control over things that are in your control.
So I think it's a very good question. Okay, I really want to know how you got saved. You mentioned that your mum, is that a long story? We're running out of time. This time is going through so fast. But you mentioned already that your mum gave her life to Jesus when she was about 40.
Yeah, we were irreligious.
Yeah.
And so my grandmother was Roman Catholic, although I don't know if she ever said that, but she never went to Mass. But every person from El Salvador seemed like they were Roman Catholic, so it was sort of like our national religion. And my grandfather was an atheist who believed in reincarnation and taught me reincarnation. And And then when my mom came and brought us to the States, I didn't know what her faith system was at all. But I remember once she brought a Buddha home and for a season. So in my mind, we became Buddhists. And then she started reading the writings of Rabbi Kishner on why bad things happen to good people. And I remember she told me she was a Jew. But really, she was describing a deist. She believed there was a God, but he was uninvolved in our lives. And she even alluded to the fact that there could not be a God with all the suffering in the world. So I had all these different views informing me. And by the time I was in sixth grade, I read every mythology book in the library. And I was really intrigued by mythologies and wondered why we created them and was there truth in them. And, and then when I skipped forward to college, I became a philosophy student and started reading everything, you know, I mean, just from Aristotle and Plato to, you know, Brooke Humes to, you know, Thoreau to, you know, just Locke and Descartes. And I was really studying all this to try to figure out if there's any real meaning in life. And I was trying to figure out, did anyone know the answers I was looking for? So it really postured me really well to crash into Jesus. Yeah. And so I'm in college and my mom calls me and says, I'm a Christian. I have no idea what that is. I mean, zero. But she was happy, and I was not I was not irreligious or against religion. Yeah. I just was, if you believe in God, I would argue there was no God.
Yeah.
And if you did not believe in God, I would argue there was a God.
Okay.
I really didn't have a position.
You're an antagonist.
I just liked the conflict. And you know, it was a part of it for me, you know.
Yeah.
And some of it was like I thought, if someone can win this argument, maybe I can figure out what's real.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, so I was hoping I would eventually lose the argument because I wanted to find myself.
Yeah.
You know, and so I didn't know when I went to see my mom in Florida that she had had this religious experience, and that's how I would describe it then, right? Yeah. You know, and that she was going to church, which I didn't even know churches existed. I would have never identified a church in my life.
Wow. Okay.
And I'd never seen a Bible in my life that I could, except maybe once. And so I was trying to figure out, is she in a cult? Is, you know, has she lost her mind? And then my sister started going, which I thought was a little bit odd. It was, I felt like it was brainwashing these junior high girls. And, you know, I didn't see everything from a positive filter.
Mm-hmm.
My brother was an atheist and he starts going to church and he's older than me. And I'm thinking, what a hypocrite. He's an atheist and he's going to church. It just seems wrong. I even confronted him. I said, you're an atheist. Yeah. What are you doing going to church? And he said, there's great volleyball and beautiful girls. And so I thought, I can understand that motivation, you know? So I watched them all come to faith in Jesus. So I was the only one that was not. And it was a little confusing because I knew how broken my family was. I knew how immoral my family was.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what's the deal? Does God have any standards?
Okay, you know? So what was the deal breaker? What was the thing that broke that?
I kept meeting people that claimed Jesus.
Yeah.
That I really liked better than I liked myself.
Yeah.
And even when I'd argue with them, they were really not trained and equipped to argue, but they were so alive.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept walking away thinking, I won the argument, but I think I still lost because I'm still me.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. And I think they won because they're still them. And so it was really almost like an essence thing.
Yeah.
I wanted to be a person that I could admire. You know, and I felt like there was some wholeness and some joy and genuine love and compassion. And I guess now in retrospect, I was seeing Jesus in them, but I didn't know.
Yes.
You know, and
well, you wouldn't have known because you didn't know Jesus.
I didn't know that. That would have seemed like really weird to me for a person to say Jesus is inside of me. I'm going, it sounds like possession or alien body snatching or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so a lot of our language doesn't make sense to people who are really, you know, outside the faith.
Yeah.
And it didn't to me. And then my brother became a person of faith. And I remember telling him, if God accepts you, God has no standards. I didn't understand grace.
Yeah.
I thought you had to hit a criteria.
Yeah.
You had to be pretty good, get to a spot. You know, if there's a God out there, he certainly has some standards, right? You know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I finally realized that in some odd way, God has no standards.
Yes.
And I had this desperation inside of me, but I wouldn't let anybody see it. And so I flew my girlfriend in from another state to try to end my God inner conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And after she was with me a couple of days, I remember just sitting on the side of a street and I just started weeping. And she'd never seen me cry. I was emotionless in that way. And she didn't know what to do. And the reason I was crying is I realized she couldn't feed what my soul was longing for.
Mm-hmm.
So I put her on a plane and sent her back. And it was then that I didn't have enough information. You know, I wish I could say it was an intellectual decision, or I studied all these religions and boom, Jesus made the most sense. It wasn't really like that.
Yeah.
It was kind of a desperate act. Mm-hmm. I just said, God, if you're out there, and Jesus, if you're real, I'm in.
Yeah.
And so I feel like the eruption of faith came after.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and I think sometimes we try to make things over technical, you know, and we don't realize that God's actually pursuing us.
Yes.
And it's almost like I gave him the slightest, smallest opening and he took it and he changed me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was as incapable of denying Jesus after I gave my life to Jesus as I was incapable of understanding him before.
Right. Yeah.
And I still remember the evening. I still remember the moment.
Yeah.
And it changed everything for me.
It is. It's just like that, isn't it? I remember going into even that point of making that decision. Okay, Jesus, if you're for real, then I'm going to take you on board.
Mm-hmm.
But prior to that, I could have, within minutes even, I could have said, I cannot buy this because I cannot believe that you can tell me the whole world started with Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, that was a stumbling block for me. It's like, how can you tell me that all of these people and all these cultures and races exist and it came from Adam and Eve? I just can't believe it. I remember then having that encounter that evening, and we were in a church building and a church meeting. I went with friends. And then the next morning I woke up and I just, everything within my heart had just changed. I could possibly, it became a possibility.
Yeah. And that's a part of, for me, how I couldn't even imagine ever denying the reality of God or the reality of Jesus, is that no one told me what was supposed to happen inside of me.
Mm.
It just happened.
Yeah.
And I didn't have any backgrounds. No one prepped me. I didn't grow up in church, so I wasn't pre-trained, you know, to believe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when you have an encounter with the creator of the universe and it changes you, you're just trying to catch up to understanding it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sure. I didn't have the information, and then it all started unwrapping. I was in the middle of it going, God, what in the world is happening to me? And I'm just trying to understand as fast as possible. And it's funny, I became a follower of Jesus, and within a few days I tell my mom, I'm not going back to college. I'm going to go from city to city telling people about Jesus.
Yeah.
I had never even read the Bible. I didn't know that's what the disciples did. And
okay.
She got really nervous because I didn't go to college right away, so she was happy I went. There's no way you need to go back. But my mind was, people don't know.
Yeah,
that the creator of the universe loves them, that, you know, that God has stepped into human history. And I remember the reason I went from there to get my master's degree in Texas is I asked these people, what's the furthest west I can go? I wanted to go to where Christianity had not yet gone. And when I went out to California, I thought, I'm going to be the first person that goes to California that tells anyone about Jesus.
I knew nothing.
I was so disappointed when they were already like, people who believe in Jesus out there going, dang it.
Churches here.
You know. And then, you know, you see it everywhere. It's like when you buy a Mini Cooper, you never saw one before, but then when you buy one, you see it everywhere.
Yeah.
Now that I'm a follower of Jesus, I see churches everywhere. I'm meeting, you know, Christians everywhere. I'm going, where were all these people before? Where were all these buildings before? And but you know, on the other side is like, once you come to life, you see life everywhere.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful thing.
So I think it's fascinating that you've come from an industry that was involved with filmmaking and fashion design. I love that. I absolutely love that you've come from that world. But now you find yourself actually being a full-time pastor and minister and leader and church builder.
Yeah, I've never been a full-time anything. I'm a full-time.
Okay.
You know, and so
great. You do a bit of everything.
Yeah, you know, because I would consider one of my primary careers as being a writer. Like I see writing as an art form, and and it's probably the first thing, looking back even in my childhood, that I ever wanted to be.
Yeah.
So right now I'm working on a graphic novel from a mythology I created out of the Persian Empire, and so I'm always writing and creating, and I think I'm a storyteller, and then I look for different mediums.
Yeah.
You know, to tell stories that change people's lives. But I'm a pastor, and it's really weird for me to say that.
Yeah.
I never really felt totally comfortable with it. And I've always worked outside the church. So the church was never my vocation.
Right.
You know, and so I worked as a futurist for 30 years and as a filmmaker and a fashion designer and had different companies. And so my income was always outside.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say, that's why I say full time, you know, it's like, it's full passion.
Right.
There's no such thing to me as full time because you're always doing multiple things with your life, you know, because I'm also a full time husband, but I'm not always with my wife, and I'm always a full time father, but I'm not always with my kids.
Yeah.
So I think it's really more full heart than it is full time.
Yeah. Okay.
And
yeah.
Yeah. I'm full hearted. I'm full hearted for the church.
Yeah.
And I want to make a difference in the world by helping create an entirely new expression of the church for this time in human history.
Yeah.
And that's a huge passion for
me. Okay. So could you just describe for me Mosaic Church, which is your church that you and your wife Kim started however many years ago in Los Angeles?
Almost 30 years ago,
California.
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, one of the uniquenesses is that we're just called Mosaic.
Okay.
But the church around the world always adds church. And I would say that's one of the distinguishing factors of Mosaic.
Yeah.
Is that the church, even the best churches, the most contemporary and the most creative churches, really are postured to have a conversation with the church, with Christians. Mm-hmm. And Mosaic is really postured to have a conversation with humanity. Mm-hmm. And so we don't really divide between Christians and non-Christians. And so our language is very human. And it's interesting, even when I was at the Sydney Conference of Color, one of the pastors came up to me and asked me, how did you learn this peculiar language? They said, have we ever heard the Bible taught with the language that you're using? Mm. I said, if you break it down, it's actually just English. Mm. You know, I just don't use a highly Christianized language. Mm. And so very little of the things I say have to be redefined for a person without Jesus.
Yeah.
It makes as much sense for them. I said, you know, because if you grew up in France, you speak French or Japanese, you know, if you grew up in Japan, and people who grew up in church speak Christian. They just don't know they do.
Yes.
You know, it's just like, for me, if I hear you from Australia and I listen to someone from New Zealand and I listen to someone, let's say, from South Africa, I may not be able to pick up the nuances between your accents, but you know when someone's from Australia, you know when they're from New Zealand, you know when they're South Africa, and you might even be offended if someone says, are you a Kiwi? Or, you know, and except for Brian Wooden being a Kiwi, right? You know, because the English is the same core language, but the accent and the dialect is different. And I think one of the things that makes Mosaic really different is that our dialect is actually a unchurched dialect. So when I write my books, I write about Jesus, but I use a language that a person without faith would go, yeah, this makes sense to me.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
And that's been the meticulous thing about Mosaic is, you know, it really started in a nightclub that Prince owned in downtown LA. And that culture emanated out of that expression.
Do you find then that Mosaic has created its own language?
It is. It does have a very...
Around your Christian ease, if
no.
you like.
And our language is still very... it's very secular.
Right.
We talk about spiritual things in a secular way.
Yeah. Can you give us an example? I'm trying to think of someone.
Yeah. Like we had this guest speaker. Yeah. She's awesome. She's maybe one of my favorite Christian, you know, speakers. Yeah. And the first thing she said when she walked on the stage at Mosaic was, if you love Jesus, would you just give a shout of praise? Mm. Which you could do at Hillsong. You could do at C3. You could do anywhere, at any church in the world. But if you do that at Mosaic, you just alienated a huge part of the room.
Right.
So what you've actually said is, I'm here to talk to you if you believe.
Okay.
But those are things that for me, they really make me anxious.
Yeah.
And but that person and anyone in that world would think that they did it exactly right. Does that make sense?
It does.
And no matter how many times you talk to them, they can't see it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like I spoke years ago at Planet Shakers and, over 10 years ago in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And as they picked me up at the hotel and drove me to the event, they said, when you speak truth, the place will be really responsive. I said, what do you mean? And they said, you know, when you declare truth, the place will be really responsive and they're going to be really engaged. And I said, do you mean when I say something, everyone already believes that they'll start cheering?
Mm-hmm.
They go, yes. And I said, yeah, that doesn't happen with me as much.
Mm-hmm.
When I say my most important things, the room is really more silent. They're not even sure if it's true yet. They're trying to figure out, is what he's saying right? And am I allowed to believe that? And and it's later that people respond.
Yeah.
And I think one of the differences is that Mosaic is off rhythm with Christianity.
Yeah.
And I use the metaphor of this whale that is the singular whale in the world. It's the only whale that they ever found that didn't have a pod. And they call it the loneliest whale in the world. And it's because that whales communicate through a sound.
Yeah.
And every other whale in the world is at like the 40th hertz. And so they can hear each other, communicate with each other, and find each other. But this whale somehow genetically was born to only speak at 52 hertz. And so because of that, the whales can be passing each other and they never actually see or hear this whale.
Yeah.
And this whale is unfamiliar with all the other whales in the world because it can't hear except at 52 hertz. And Mosaic is a 52 hertz church. It speaks at a frequency that people without God who are searching for God hear, but it sounds like the wrong frequency for Christians. Years ago, actually, a producer from Hillsong and came out to L.A. before you had a campus there, and our friends from Hillsong were saying, you need to go to Mosaic, you need to go to Mosaic, you need to go to Mosaic. And he called and said, nah, I can't go to Mosaic. It's a cult. Oh. And they said, why would you say it's a cult? They said, because every non-Christian I meet goes there.
Right.
And they said, no, that's what makes it different. You know. And fortunately, the pastors at Hillsong knew that we were all about Jesus and the scriptures. But it is even the way that you pull out the scriptures.
Yeah.
And talk about it. Does that make sense? You know?
Yeah.
And so it just affects all the language and everything. I tell people, when you bring in a friend who doesn't believe in God, you listen differently to everything.
You do. That is very true.
Right.
When I have someone sitting beside me and I've invited them to church and they're not churchgoers,
right,
I am ultra sensitive to every little thing that's being said or done or the music or the volume. You pick up on everything.
Yeah, and I never stop being that person.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and so even in our leadership meetings, I'm always representing the person who doesn't believe. Yeah. Even last night at 3 a.m. here, I sent a text to a journalist from Vanity Fair because he just was on my heart. And I met with him for the first time last week. He came on Easter because he's doing a story, which made me nervous. And then we got coffee for 2 hours. And he said to me, I'm an atheist and I'm Jewish. And he goes, and my wife's even more of an atheist than me, you know. And he was asking me, you know, I could see people feeling it.
Yeah.
But I don't think I felt it the way they felt it. What do I need to do? And I just started talking about, you know, spirituality is like a muscle. And if you've been an atheist all your life and you haven't exercised it, and it may feel uncomfortable. And you have to, I said, so keep coming back.
Yeah.
And then I sent him to a really beautiful experience this morning, Friday morning in LA. I said, I want you to experience faith in a secular environment with these friends of mine. And what to me was key is like, he just kept coming back to my heart all night long. So I sent him an email and I said, you know, I know this isn't your language, but you're on my heart and I'm praying for you.
Well, even the fact that you say on your heart is a very
different,
very what we would say, Christian.
And maybe like even some of the way you would use gifts, like what in a Christian environment, you'd say, I have a prophetic word for you. You just never hear that at Mosaic, you know, but you would hear someone say, hey, you know, I had this thought that maybe I wanted to share with you. And then might even go, I know it sounds strange, but I think maybe God is like telling me this. And so I just want to share it with you and you could figure out whether it's real for you.
Yeah.
And we tend to not use as much like God talk, you know, but we were really God present.
Yeah.
That's just it. And it's not right or wrong. It's just different.
I get it. I understand it.
Yeah.
To be honest, I think Gary challenges Dan sitting here as well. And I think you would agree with me, Dan, wouldn't you? That Gary often challenges us in things that we might say or even people that are on the platform and speaking or emceeing even of what are you saying and does that person understand?
Well, your husband is probably one of the most ruthless thinkers I've ever met. And I mean that is an incredible compliment. That's why I admire Gary so much. And I love him, and my kids know. Like, I mean, when Gary sent me a text, I responded probably within 5 seconds. and I didn't even look at anything. He said, "Can you?" And I said, "Yes." Because to me, Gary's one of those people. If he asks me to do anything, I'm a yes.
See, that's why Gary sent you the text about speaking here.
But a lot of it is because he's such a he's a brilliant thinker.
He is.
And he's ruthless in his own self-examination of whether he's doing things in the way that Jesus would do them in London in this time in human history. And regardless of whether it's acceptable, like he doesn't try to figure out, and I probably shouldn't say this, but he doesn't try to figure out what Hillsong does. He assumes that whatever Jesus would do is what Hillsong does. And even if it doesn't do it yet, it will. And that's what I like about him is like, I don't try to figure out what does Mosaic do. I try to figure out what would Jesus do in this environment, in this world, and that's what Mosaic does. So, you know, the culture doesn't submit to Mosaic's culture. You know, Mosaic submits to the essence and culture that Jesus is creating in the world.
Awesome. Owen, our time has just flown by. I cannot believe it. We are well over time, and we need to get you to have some lunch because there's other stuff going on as well this afternoon for color. You know, when you were just speaking in there and you said that you'd just been on the holiday with your wife in Ireland.
Oh, that was one back, season, yeah.
And she kind of looked at you and went, I've been 3 days and you haven't spoken to me. But you're thinking, I've had lots of conversations, but the only conversations going on in your head. I'm sitting up there in my seat going, oh my gosh, I have to talk to this guy for a good 30, 40 minutes. What am I going to say? You are surprisingly very easy to converse with.
Oh, thank you so much.
And it's been really enjoyable having a conversation. You are a great storyteller.
Oh, well, my daughter, I think, really had an opportunity to have a conversation with you last night,
yes,
Mariah.
Yeah, I chatted with Mariah.
And she goes, I met Kathy Cook, and she is amazing.
Yeah,
and Mariah is a very tight filter.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to impress Mariah.
All right.
You know, there's some people whose inner circle is like an open circle. The whole world's in their inner circle. Mariah is one of those people with a very, very tight circle of respect.
Yeah.
And she was just raving about you. Yeah. And I want you to know that I was like actually excited to do your podcast because you're really a brilliant thinker. Thoughtful and powerful as a human being. And I had this thought for color. I'm going to leave you with this.
Oh, yeah. Go for it.
I had this internal manuscript on that women are in danger of manhandling the future.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because mm-hmm. if women lead like men, they'll create the same future that men created in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't need women who lead like men. We need women who lead like men should have led.
Mm.
And we keep dividing between male and female.
Mm.
There were great men leaders in history. And there have been an endless number of terrible men leaders in history. Mm. And just because, because I just came from the secular event, and where women leaders were there, and I thought, the goal of the future shouldn't be to have women leaders. The goal of the future should be to have great leaders.
Yeah.
And to have good people lead greatly.
Yeah.
And so I just want to encourage you, because I think what you're doing is really important, because you are thoughtful and you are intentional, and you're the kind of leader women need to become. And I think what you're doing at Color is you're calling women not just to lead, but to lead differently.
Mm-hmm.
And because I hope the future is filled with men and women who lead differently
exactly.
than men and women have led historically. Yeah. And so I just want to encourage you guys and thank you for what you're doing all over the world and for letting me be a small part of Color. I joked that I came here to be the woman I was always created to be.
Awesome. All right. Thank you so much. Thank you for your time. We know it's precious and we really do appreciate
it. Thank you so much, Kathy.
And yeah. See you later, everybody. Right. We're finished. We're done. Well, that's it for today. Thanks for listening. Why not join in the conversation on social media? You can follow us as Convos with Kathy on both Instagram and Facebook, where it's now easier than ever to share an encouraging podcast with your friends. Till next time, see ya.